All right, if you'll turn to 1 Samuel chapter 27. Okay, so 1 Samuel 27 is not a very long chapter. 12 verses. But as I was reading this, what I realized was kind of along the lines of what Benjamin had reminded us is that you can't always just you can't just go straight through a book. Sometimes it jumps around. You know, it'll kind of have a little storyline going here, then it'll jump over this storyline here. And really, this is kind of what happens here with Samuel. This chapter starts a storyline. It kind of continues the David storyline, but it's a shift in the storyline that actually doesn't get done until the end of the book, almost. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just run you through the storyline here. That's really the whole big part of it. And we're going to focus on this first part of the story. But I think it would be helpful to have the whole sort of episode, so to speak, of David's life here in our minds as we're talking about this particular chapter today. I'm going to summarize it. So y'all just kind of follow along in your Bibles. We'll end up kind of at the end of 1 Samuel here. And so in chapter 27, this is where David flees to the Philistines. He stays with them for a while. And then the story continues in chapter 29. Chapter 28 except for the first couple of verses there, chapter 28 is mostly about Saul. And so there's a little break in the storyline here. They jump over to Saul, and then it goes to David. And then so David has been with the Philistines, and then what happens is he's been there. He's given a city to stay in, and they're kind of going about their business, and the Philistines decide to invade Israel. This is where chapter 9 picks up, and chapter 29 picks up. And then, so because David has been in Philistia and has sort of voluntarily joined up with this little kingdom of Philistia, he's now, and they gave him a city to stay in. We're going to talk about all this. He's now actually going to be required to go with them to war against the Israelites. So he starts to do this, and then they send him back home. And then there's the whole episode where they have to go rescue their families while they're away, that they were captured. And then this battle that he sort of got conscripted into, it's more like the old feudal system where if you lived under a lord and he gave you some land and some serfs, then when it was time, when that lord needed to go to battle, he would say, okay, now you come help me because I've given you this land to profit off of. Your return to me is when I need your help, you come help me. That's kind of what David was in at this point. And so this battle that the Israelites go to do, the battle that they're going to fight, is the battle where Saul and Jonathan are killed. Okay, so that ties this all together. See, this would have been the battle, if David had ended up going, it would have been the battle where Saul gets killed in. So that's the battle that they go in. Saul is defeated. The battle is going on. While the battle is going on, David is off doing his rescue effort, which somebody will probably talk about after, you know, in a week or two. But this is all going on at one time. Now, in our linear Bible, you'd have to like put it going on separate, you know, columns. You'd have to read it together at the same time to know that these two things are going at the same time. The battle gets completed. The result of that is Saul's dead. David accomplishes his purpose, ends up back in Ziklag, and finds out about Saul's death. And that's sort of the springboard into 2 Samuel, where David assumes, well, not right away, there's some of Saul's family that kind of comes in, but for all intents and purposes, Saul's out of the picture now. David assumes the throne, so to speak. It takes him 7 years to kind of really establish it, but he's not getting chased by Saul anymore. He doesn't have that to worry about anymore. Okay? So that's the big picture I want y'all to kind of have in your minds right now. So now that we have this big picture, this, I'm going to remind you about what's been going on. Okay? Right quick. Remember, had David in the cave, David and Saul in the cave, episode 1. Then we had a few things happen. Then we had David goes into Saul's camp, has a chance to kill him there. So episode 2. That's kind of where we stopped. David's had his two chances to kill Saul. He has refrained both times. Each time Saul has said, "Oh, David, I'm sorry. I'm not going to do this anymore." And then he goes and keeps on chasing it, right? So that's where we are. That's what David, and remember, I'm going to remind you about this too. Very, 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 very easy as we're reading this to say, to start reading things into it because we know what the end is. We've read the whole book before. Remember, David doesn't know what the end is. David is right here in his life and all he has is what's been going on. And so, remember that as we get started here. And because in verse 1, we have a glimpse into David's weakness, the weakness of David. Let's read it. "And David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand.'" I just have to put the brakes on myself because I'm sitting here and I'm not David. But if I'm sitting here thinking, David, all the things that God's done, and he just gave you the opportunity to kill him and everything, and now here you are, and you've been anointed, God's made you the promise, the prophets have, you know, Samuel and other prophets have spoken that you are going to be the king. And what does he say? He says, "I'm going to perish." He loses hope here. He loses hope. And when he loses hope, he stops looking to God. He doesn't consult God here. Remember in the past, he's consulted God. Remember when he did that? He did it at Keilah. He said, you know, "Hey, are these guys going to give me up?" God said, "Yep, they're going to give you up." So he leaves. Trusted God, and no harm came to him. He went and consulted God. He's going to consult God later. He's going to consult God when he comes back and finds the family's gone. He's going to say, "God, do I go after him?" He says, "Yes, go after him, you'll be successful." And I think probably if you look at the whole big picture, I think that's a little bit of indication of where we can see where his belief is strong, his belief gets weak. His belief gets strong again. And I think those times of weaknesses, one thing we can take out of that is these times of weaknesses, I think he learns from it. I think it's one of those things where you get in these situations where you get like in a haze and all you can see is what's right there in front of you and all you can do and you get kind of like, "Oh, how is this ever going to work out?" And then, and that's unbelief. And we all suffer from it from time to time. But then, as God brings you through the trial, as He brings you out of the haze, and you look back and you go, "Oh, why did I ever doubt?" Then you feel, and you're like, "Okay, I see what I'm supposed to do again." And I think that's what happened with David. He knew he should be consulting God. Here, he does not consult God. He says what? He basically said, you could read this where it said he said in his heart. You could read it this way. You could read it like he said to his heart. What's that? What's going on there? That's his brain telling him what to do instead of letting God, through his heart, telling him what to do. It's him. It's him saying, I'm not trusting in God here. I'm trusting in my own ability. And when I look at this, I reason, I'm about to perish. I got to run. Whereas if he had consulted God, I don't think God would have told him to do this. So he said, so when he consults his own self instead of consulting God here. And you can also read this where he says, so I shall escape out of his hand. Didn't say, so God will deliver me out of his hand. He's now trying to take control himself. And so this isn't stone throwing, but this is a time, I mean, he's forgotten all the times that God's delivered him. What was the first known time God delivered David? Who wants to tell me? First known time. The lion and the bear. Good job. He delivered him from the lion and the bear. Second time. Goliath. Third time. Saul. Right. Saul. You got Saul 1, Saul 2, Saul 3, Saul 4, right? You got lots of Saul deliverances, and yet here he is. He's forgotten all that. He's gotten in the haze. He's gotten in the fog, which is the fog of unbelief. We get in that, we start looking into ourselves, we start looking to God, and this is where David is. So, what did he do? Verse 2. David rose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. So David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelite, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. And it was told David, Saul, that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. All right, there's a few interesting things in here. First of all, I want to look at this, his wife, Ahinoam. As far as I can tell, this is the first time we were told that he has him as his wife. We know about him going and getting Abigail. After Nabal dies, he hears about it and goes and gets Abigail. We talked about that last week. But this is the first instance of Ahinoam being talked about. Now, Ahinoam is mentioned twice in the Bible in terms of as relative to David's wife. And, well, more than actually. She's mentioned twice in the context of saying wife of David. And then she's also mentioned as the mother of one of his children. So that's another mention. But she is the mother of David's eldest son, Ammon. So, no children, no sons before David marries Ahinoam. And she bears him his first son, and that's Ammon. And you can read about what Ammon, results of Ammon in 2 Samuel. They weren't too good. There's a possibility also that this is the Ahinoam that was the wife of Saul. Saul had a wife named Ahinoam as well. It's not specific. It's never said specific, but he had a wife. And there is a prophecy. I don't have the reference, but there's a prophecy to David, and it says, "You shall have the wives of your enemies." That doesn't necessarily mean this Ahinoam of Saul's was the same one, but it could be. It's just a little FYI there, I guess. So, if you were wondering about Ahinoam, I thought, who is this Ahinoam? I was wondering if she was important. She's important in the fact that she was the mother of Ammon, and Ammon is going to factor into David's history later. And if she was the wife of Saul, who he sort of captured away or whatever, then, or the wife, if she was a Jezreelist from Jezreel, it could factor into why Ammon didn't turn out too good. But anyway. Also, the next thing I want to point out was here that was where Saul. When Saul was told that David had fled, he sought him no more. That's the same thing as saying, Saul, did not mean what he said when he said he was going to lead David along. He was still seeking him because he had to be seeking him to seek him no more. And so it was likely that Saul had spies out, kind of following David around, seeing what David was doing. And when the spies see him heading south, southwest, wouldn't it be southwest? Southwest, toward Philistia, they came back, they told Saul, and Saul gave up at that point. Now, Matthew Henry makes a good point. He says, in relation to Saul here, he says, many seem to leave their sins, but in reality, their sins leave them. And if you remember, Saul, at one point, sent David on an errand, hoping that the Philistines would kill him. Remember that? When he sent him on the errand to get the bride price for Maacah? And so, in this case, I mean, here's Saul. He gets his spy back, and his spy says, David's head to Philistia. So Saul's like, well, number one, I don't want to go down into Philistia with an army. I can't take just 3,000 guys to do that. I'm going to need all my army because then I'm going to be subject to Philistia coming and attacking me. So I don't really want to go after him. And so, well, maybe the Philistines will kill him for me. So this indication that Saul sought him no more cannot be taken as Saul being repentant here. There's no reason to take it that way. But that's a good. To me, that was a good thing to remember. Is that be careful that you don't deceive yourself, because just because you don't have the opportunity to sin doesn't mean you have given up that sin. Now, so David's on his way back, or he is there. He's now arrived in Philistia. Remember, Philistia had five kings. And they each had their own royal city. And Gath was this one of those royal cities. There's another one. Anybody think of any of the other royal cities? And Ekron. Remember Ekron with the idol that fell down? Gaza. I think Gaza. Isn't that where we are? Gath and Gaza, Ekron, and there's another one that starts with Ashdod. Good, Ashdod. There's one more, but I can't remember. It's unimportant. But I thought we would see if we could remember them all. So he's going to Gath. This is not the first time he's been to Gath. Does anybody remember when he went to Gath before? Remember when he ran from Saul? Yeah, he went to Samuel, and then he went back to Jonathan, and Jonathan did the whole bow and arrow thing, and he went and he ran to Philistia. So this is not the first time he has thought, if I go to Philistia, then Saul, I can get away from Saul. Well, it didn't work out good the first time either. And really, it's going to seem on the surface it works out good here, but it's one of those situations where I believe that in this, though God doesn't really punish David, so to speak, too much for this, David falls, he stumbles through this period of time. So the first time he went to Gath, it didn't turn out good, but he was all alone. Remember that? He just fled to Gath. And this time, though, he goes and he's got 600 men with him. But the similarity is what? The similarity is, in both instances, he's not trusting God. He is trusting in himself. It's like, I'm running, I'm afraid of Saul. He's in fear, and when you find yourself in fear, I mean, put an alert on your phone or something that goes off to say, you are in danger of making a bad simple decision when you make decisions in fear. So David, we're going to move on now to the next 5-6 here. David said to Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you. So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. Now the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 full year and 4 months. Now this is New King James right here. So David comes in and he's got, it's not just David. It's David and his family. And it's David and 600 men, and 600 men have family too. Not all of them, but some of them do, because we find out later when they all get captured. And they go back and get their families from the Malachites, I think. Yeah. So he's come into this city, but you know, the city, I mean, we're not talking about like a city of like Birmingham with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in it to start with. So bringing 600 people in, all of a sudden, bam, you know, probably put a pretty strain on them. Now, Ziklag is where they're going to give him. They're going to give him the town of Ziklag, and it might seem odd, but most likely, the Philistines sent a delegation with Saul and told everybody, get out, go somewhere else and live. And they gave him Ziklag. Some of them may have stayed, but Ziklag actually was part of the land of Judah initially. So this was part of the land of, or put it this way, they come into the promised land, and who's already there? The Philistines, Amalekites, Canaanites, Jebusites, Perizzites, Hittites, Hibzites, all those ites people are there, and so they're there. I mean, so really it's kind of like, yeah, Ziklag was part of the area of Judah that God said, this is Judah. Go take it, right? And so, and then, I don't know if you're kind of familiar with this, but when they gave the borders of Simeon's area, it actually was kind of inside Judah. It may have had a little bit of border, but it was kind of like, there's Judah, and here's Simeon. And Ziklag ended up in there. So it was interesting how that worked out. But, you know, we're not really told why exactly David asked for this area. You know, I kind of hinted that, you know, they're putting a lot of those people in there. They're putting a strain on them. They're not Philistines. So there might be some cultural tension there. I think it was probably a wise move, but we're not told why. But he does ask to be given an area where he can live peaceably. And now we're kind of back in that whole serfdom type lord, more sort of medieval type situation where he's now become sort of he's been given a section of land, so he's got responsibilities to Achish now. So I want to talk just a minute about where it says how long he was there. New King James says 1 full year and 4 months. What's New King James say? I mean, what's King James say? Did I say that right? Anybody got King James? You got King James? What's it say? Does it say what?
Same thing.
Same thing? ESV? Who got ESV? What's it say? What you got?
New American Standard, it says a year and 4 months.
Okay. Anybody got ESV? I know my boys do. Same thing? Okay. So, you might... The word there that's translated 1 full year is the word yom. It's the same word that's in Genesis 1 where it talks about, and on the first day God created. Yeah. It typically means day. So, I just pointed this out because you might run across different time frames here, how long he was there. He was there at least 4 months. It could have been a year and 4 months. In the context, in the immediate context, it doesn't have an impact how long he was there. But, you know, it's one of those things where it is good to try to do your best to. So we're going to go with a year and 4 months. A year and 4 months would you know, as I think about it, a year and 4 months would work. 4 months would work, but it talks. We're fixing to find out he's not just sitting there twiddling his thumbs while he's there. They're going out on raids and coming back, and you know they're not taking their Humvee to do this. I mean, they're having to walk when they go or take their horses or camels or whatever. So I mean, they're taking 600 people too. We're talking, you know, there's a baggage train and you know they're having to. So it's going to take some time to get from point A to point B, make your raid, get back with all the loot. And the loot, by the way, isn't, I mean, they're not putting all the animals onto train cars and trucking them. I mean, these sheep don't go very fast. So, and they can't go very fast with the sheep or the sheep die from being you know, over-exercised. So the point is that he needs some time to be able to accomplish what we're fixing to read about him accomplishing. So he was there at least 4 months, possibly a year and a half or so. Okay, verse 8. Any questions, comments? I'm not really slowing down. Jonathan? I think I read it's about 15 miles. Right. Yeah, we are going to see that. And we're also, okay, so to give you some geographical references, Mediterranean Sea is over here. Got to get oriented. Mediterranean Sea is over here. Philistia is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Judah is in the southern part of Israel. It's, you know, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, about top of the Dead Sea down. It's kind of the Judah area. Maybe a little bit off on that. But Philistia's over here on the coast. All the five cities are sort of in a northern, north-south line. Not straight up and down, but along the coast there. Ziklag is on the border. It's in Philistia, but it's kind of on the border between where the no man zone is, the demilitarized zone between Judah and Philistia. So it's in Philistia, but it's toward Judah, if that makes any sense. Give you a geographical location. It's going to be southwest of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's going to be kind of up here. It's going to be kind of here. Philistia's kind of right here. But it's not very far from Gath. Isn't that where it is? Gath. Somebody said Gaza, and I got them both in my head. All right. So in verse 8, so David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gizurites, Gerzites. Let me start over. The Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. Okay. For those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. Whenever David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, camels, and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. Okay. This is important here. It's all important, but this is the next important part. So, anybody ever heard of the Gerzites? Well, believe it or not, neither had Google. When I Googled who were the Gerzites, I got no hits, no appeals, no instances. So, I did a little bit more digging. Gerzites, this is the only place in the Bible where the word Gerzites occurs in reference to the people called the Gerzites. There is a city called Gezer, but that's up in north, just north of Ziklag, kind of. Not like way up in the north part of Israel, but it's north of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is north of Ziklag. So I don't think that's where it's talking about. And the reason I say this is because it says in here, as you go to Shur. Shur is a reference of an area toward Egypt. So that would be south. Now there's also the Geshurites. And the Geshurites, there's a city in northern Israel called Geshur. So those technically would be Geshurites up there. But there were also apparently Geshurites in the region of Philistia. And so initially I thought, well, if he went, maybe he was going north and telling, a big fat lie to Achish saying he was going south. But it does say in the text here that inhabitants of old, as you go to Shur. So these must not have been the people up in these cities, but a different set of people. Maybe they had moved down south, but they were from there originally, so they kind of kept their name. But I think what we have to do is, because it's in the text, it says these were people, as you go to Shur, and we're gonna say they aren't those people up north. There were some people down south. Henry suggests that they were branches, or they were just sort of split offs from the Amalekites. Now the Amalekites were definitely lived south of Judah, and that was their home territory, the Amalekites. So, and this is all going to be important in just a minute. So if we look back in Deuteronomy 7, we're going to read where it says, talking about, this is recounting the instructions given to Moses going into the promised land. It says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And he goes on to talk to them. So the point here is that when they were called to go into the land, they were called to destroy these people. Now, the Amalekites are not actually in this particular list, but the Amalekites were in another time, because as they were coming out of Egypt, coming in, Amalekites gave them a lot of trouble. And I don't have the reference, but there's another reference where it speaks to the Amalekites specifically, and that God was like, destroy them all. So, we just wanted to remind you of that. Okay, so let's put all this together. We have here God imposing complete destruction on these people that David is going to attack. So, because of that, in one sense, David has authority from God to go and attack these people. Now, if he were going to attack these people from vengeance or some other simple matter, it wouldn't matter the fact that God had told him to do it. He still would be acting in sin. Okay? But, there's a lot of people out there who are going to want to say, well, yeah, it's a mean God that he would tell somebody to go and kill everybody, including the women and children, all this. Well, that's somebody trying to be God, okay? Because either God's God or you're God, and you don't get to tell God that he's mean, because you're not good enough to do that. So there's a little bit of philosophy for you right there. So when somebody says that, you have a very simple one. It's the same answer for why would a good God allow evil? That's basically what they're asking when they say something like that. And the answer is, he is good, and he does allow it, and if you don't understand why, it's not his fault, it's your fault. So, that's my little philosophy lesson in a nutshell. But the reality here is that we don't have any indication that David has any malice in his heart toward these people, except from the perspective of, these are the enemies of God, I'm going to go destroy them, and I do actually kind of need some stuff, so this will supply my needs as well. And so, he goes, he attacks them multiple times, And at least it appears it's multiple times, because it says Ray did all three. I guess I can't say that definitively. It could be he went on one raid and raided all three of them. Which, going back to the whole whether it's a year and 4 months or 4 months, I guess if it was only 4 months, maybe he only had time to raid them one time. Again, in the context of what we're trying to do today, that's not relevant. But the point is that he goes, he raids these three different peoples, either does it all one time or does it multiple times, and then he not only he attacks them, and he leaves nobody alive to tell the tale. But he takes all the spoil back with him. Now, it's possible that David carried this out. I want to talk about the fact that he didn't leave anybody alive. Yes, God had commanded that they all be destroyed. This goes back to what I was saying before. But what's really important for David is, what was David thinking? Okay, because you know what you can do? You can say, well, God wants me to do this. I'm going to do this. But if you're not doing it simply because God told you to do it, you can very well be doing something that God wants done, but doing it with wrong motives, in which case, you are accomplishing the purposes of God, but in doing it, you're actually sinning as you do it. Does that make sense? Tell me if that makes sense. You mean to say it again? Yeah. Well, my point is that you could be doing something that is obedience to God, but if you're doing it out of improper motivation, you're doing it in sin. Yet God's accomplishing His purposes. Okay? Now, so we have a hint here that we have to be a little bit concerned about David. In just a minute, we're going to have a hint that we need to be concerned about. William.
Why are you saying that God ordered this?
I'm not saying that he told David, go kill him. I'm saying that in the past, there have been, God has spoken to the people and said, you know, when you get in the land, wipe them all out. And on the way up from Egypt, the Amalekites I don't have the reference. I have to find it later. But as they were coming up out of Egypt, the Amalekites would attack them, and they weren't in a position to right then destroy them. But God told them, and different prophets prophesied the complete destruction of the Amalekites because of the what you got. You have
told Saul to wipe them out, and he didn't do it.
Yeah, I actually got that in my notes here in just a minute.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, in this context, would it be still considered some kind of binding, or if he's just taking this on himself? Would be my question.
Well, there's nothing that says because God said to go do it, he went and did it. Okay. But what I'm saying is that.
But would it even apply to him in that context? Well, in the context here, is the order still valid for him?
If the order was, the order was for Saul to go do it, and he didn't do it all.
And they were supposed to drive them out little by little. God was not going to drive them completely out all at one time, so that the land would not become overrun with wildness. And so as Israel was to expand, they were to go and continue to destroy these nations. But the thing was, they weren't supposed to let them live within their borders. They were supposed to destroy them from within their borders. And because they didn't, because they put them under bondage and things of that nature, God says, okay, I will not drive them completely out, but they're going to be a thorn in your side all the rest of your days.
Right.
But for David to go, because God blessed David later as a king, and he expanded the borders of Israel dramatically through that blessing of attacking the Philistines and
I'm pointing this out as a rebuttal to those who would point to this as David, as God having, they want to speak against God because of what David, these type of things that like David did it, other people, other military would did it as well. I'm pointing out that This could have been done in righteousness. David could be doing this in righteousness if he's going for the right motive, with the right motives. If he's going out of fear, if he's going out of revenge or something like that, then even though he's accomplishing God's purpose, he's not doing it in righteousness, in faith. And therefore, he is actually sinning in the process of accomplishing God's purpose, which was kind of the point. I'm not sure I made it, but... Does that make sense?
I was just working in my head if this would be considered like, I guess you call it standing order. You know, anybody who did it would be okay because it's sort of out there.
Yeah, I would think so. That's my understanding from the whole of, I mean, not just now this little piece of Scripture, but from, you know, it was told to Israel to drive them out. And so they had a standing order to get it done.
There's a little bit of a rebellion in Israel in that sense that hadn't got done
yet. Yeah, well, the rebellious part would be, like Ben said, when they did conquer somebody and they didn't slaughter them all, and they kind of kept them as slaves or something like that, that would be the rebellious part. The fact that they hadn't completed the process yet was not necessarily rebellious, because God did say that you were to do it gradually. And kind of, you go in, establish a beachhead, and then push everybody, and then destroy as you expand. And the idea was, in fact, I read the reference, but I don't have it written down. But the idea was, specifically in the text, the idea is, you don't have enough numbers right now to completely fill up the land. So go in, fill up an area such that, you know, maybe you're not, you know, not that you're like, you know, elbow to elbow, but that you can manage it. Like, for instance, you know, if you only got one family and they're trying to manage 100 acres back then, they can't manage it. I mean, it's just going to get, it's going to go wild again on them because there's not enough labor to keep it managed, okay? So what God's saying is, you don't have enough labor yet to manage this whole promised land I'm giving you. Go in, establish yourself, and as you multiply and prosper, and as you have more labor, move out, conquer, like that. And so do it slowly over time, but do it progressively.
Also, in that, where we first started with the attitude about why you're doing it, both the Assyrians and the Babylonians were sent by God to be an instrument of punishment to His people. And yet, the attitude with which those kingdoms came are spoken against by God, saying, you did it with an attitude of pride, and therefore you will be judged for your pride and actually the horror with which you did it. In Isaiah 10, verse 12, it says, wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed His whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, this is His work, He is doing this, He is bringing Assyria here to destroy, but when this is done, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it. By my wisdom, for I am prudent, I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures and put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. My hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, as one gathers eggs that are left. So shall the ox boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? And so forth. So, yes, the attitude with which we obey God is extremely important.
Okay, so the point here is that God can hit a straight lick with a crooked stick. Now, the question is how crooked was our stick we're talking about here? So verse 10, so remember, in verse 9, he took away the sheep, the oxen, donkey, camels, and apparel, and returned and came where? To Ziklag? Nope. He returned to Achish. So he comes back, and he purposely goes to Gath to seek Achish. Now, we don't. It's not told why he does that. Could be that Achish said, there's your city. If you leave, you got to sit with me. Because I want to keep my eye on you. Because he knew this was David of the... David has slain his 10,000, Saul his thousands. He knew that the first time David came, by the way. So verse 10, Achish would say, and this is why I think he made more than one raise, because it said he would say, as if he said it more than once. Every time he came back, he would say this. He didn't say he did say, like he only said it one, like he only came through one time. This is what makes me think these were multiple raids. Where have you made a raid today? And David would say, against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jerahmeelites, or against the southern area of the Kenites. David would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they should inform on us, saying, thus David did. And thus was his behavior all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. So Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people Israel utterly abhor him. Therefore, he will be my servant forever. Okay. All right. Now, I want to be careful here, because I don't want to impose upon David anything that's not really here. However, and to start with, what I want to say is, just ask the question. So David was in God's will to destroy these Amalekites. We talked about that. But why did David not just say to Achish, hey, I went and attacked the Amalekites. That's where all this came from. Or I went and attacked the Gershites. This is where all this came from. Why did he not say that? Okay. He could have just as easily said, I went and attacked the Amalekites. Instead, he said, I went and attacked the southern part of Judah. Pretty vague. In fact, does anybody in the Bible say he went and attacked the Negev of Judah? Okay. All right. So I want to point this out. When you have that sort of gives you it gave me the idea that this Negev was like a particular area, like the name of a city or a region.
Well, the definition of it is that it's the south country, and the Gav is the east country.
That's where I'm going. So, the actual word is Negev, but it sounds like when you read it in those other, the Negev of Judah, that sounds like it's a part of Judah. Like, say, the Birmingham area of Alabama. See? But really, it doesn't mean a particular part of the south part of Judah. It means southern Judah. It means it's like saying the southeast. If we said America, the south, just pretend that we had, that Spain still occupied Florida, and they're in this military zone, and I said, well, I went down to the southeast and attacked the southeast part of I'm up in the north part of America, and I said, well, I'm going to the southeast to attack, and I'm coming back. Well, you wouldn't know whether I attacked somebody in Florida or I attacked somebody in Georgia, because I said I went to the south of southeast to attack. And so, where have you been? I've been down in the southeast. That's kind of what he's saying here. I've been down in southern Judah. Well, Achish doesn't know where the southern border of the God-defined southern border of Judah is. It doesn't really matter either, because we got Amalekites that are inside God's given southern border of Judah. So on the one hand, that's why it was important to establish, were these Gershurites and Gizurites actually in the south part of Israel, or were these northern folks? Because if he's saying I went to the southern part of Judah, but he actually went north, I mean, we got to complete bald-faced lie going on right there. But in this case, what appears to me is The Amalekites and these others were down in the southern parts of Judah. And so when Achish asked him, he says, I went down to the southern parts of Judah. And by the way, southern area of Judah, southern area of the Jemaliites, southern area of the Kenites, those are all southern areas of Judah, southern areas of Israel down there. Okay? This is another indication that he's making multiple raids, and when he comes back, he's not saying that, he's telling them different things, but in a sense, he's telling the same thing. He's just not saying, I went down to southern Judah. I went down to southern Judah. I went down to southern Judah. He gives them a little different area. Does that make sense? Each time. So, my question is still, why does he not just say, I went and attacked the Amalekites? Why went and attacked the Gergesites? Because in doing some reading, it seems as though these Amalekites were probably enemies of Philistia as well. And so, why did he not just say, I went and did that? So, in a sense, he is telling the truth that he did go to the southern part of Judah. But he's doing it in such a way that it leads Achish into deception. Achish believes he's attacking Judeans when he goes to the southern part of Judah. Does that make sense? And in relation to that, I just want to set that right here and let you chew on that. Now let's look at what happens. And this is one of the reasons I went ahead and gave you the whole story. Let's look at what happens. Because of what David has done here, because of what he allows Achish to believe, because he's allowing Achish to believe that I've been attacking people in Judah. I've been attacking my own people. That's what he's allowing Achish to believe. What happens because of that? What does it say? Achish, what, says, he will be my servant forever. What happens later? Now, Philistia's about to go to war. What's Achish think? David slayed his 10,000. David's my man. Everybody in Judah hates David because David's been going over and raiding them. Come on, David. See what this did to David? It actually put him in a bad spot. If he was thinking it was going to put him in a good spot, it may have temporarily, but now he's in a bad spot. He either has to refuse to go, and what's that going to tell Achish? It tells him really what his loyalty is, right? Or he's going to have to go fight his people, and it turns out, fight Saul and Jonathan. I know he doesn't want to fight Jonathan. And if he still feels the same way about Saul, not wanting to lift his hand against the Lord's anointing, he wouldn't want to do that either. And then what happens so what did he do? He does go with him. He's about to go with him. He even says, when he's told he can't go, so I'm spoiler alert for the next week or two, he even says, why can't I go? And he calls Achish, my Lord, why can't I go? I think we have a situation here where we can say that David wasn't lying, technically. He was speaking very general, and he was allowing Achish to believe something that wasn't true. We don't know if David knew for sure. I'm going to just set that right there because I don't have enough knowledge for me personally to jump on that with both feet. But what I can see, or what I think I see here, is I see that this is getting David in a bad spot because he's not being 100% open with Achish. So I think the takeaway from that is that, you know, be careful what you say. Be careful what you try to be honest. I mean, completely honest as you go. Then you won't have the whole tangled web of deception to get trapped in later. But this is what David does. And if we read the very first part of 28, that's where it talks about the Philistines gathering for war and Achish. And I thought it was very interesting, David's reply to Achish. He said, Achish says, "Hey, you understand you're to go with me. You know, you are my tenant here. This is, you know, this is what's recommended. This is what's..." And what's David say? He doesn't say, "Oh yeah, I'm on board." Again, he's having to fudge here. He's having to be careful what he says, not to lie. And say, "Yeah, I'm with you." He says, "Very well, you know what I can do." I mean, how vague is that? Now, the Philistines, remember, they're going to tell him, they're going to find out that David's with them and say, "No way, send them back." Because they're worried David's going to turn traitor on them. And maybe David, that's what David was thinking. We don't know. We don't know if that's what he was thinking or not. Now, let's draw some conclusions out of this. First conclusion is, fear God, not man. We read Psalm 118. I want to read verses 6 through 9 one more time. "The Lord is on my side, I will not fear. What can man do to me?" What does the Scripture say about who you should fear? Fear God, because what? Man can do what? He can kill your body, but God can destroy your soul. Verse 7, "The Lord is on my side as my helper. I shall look in triumph on those who hate me. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man." It's better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. David was trusting in himself instead of in God. He was fearing Saul instead of fearing God. Psalm 56, verse 8 through 11 says, "You kept count of my tossings." What's that mean? "You kept count of all the times I was anxious. You knew about my anxiety. You put my tears in your bottle." I'm so upset, I'm so worried, I'm crying, okay? Even though the Scripture says, "Do not be anxious for anything, but in everything, in prayer and supplication, present your request before the Lord." "Are they not in your book?" God knows your struggles. He knows when you're fearful, He knows about it. "Then my enemies will turn back in the day when I call. This I know, that God is for me." The enemies are coming after you. They're coming after you. You can see them coming. When do they go away? When do they go away, Mr. Dan?
When God turns them away.
When does God turn them away?
When we trust Him.
When you call upon Him. Call upon the Lord in your day of trouble. "In God whose word I praise, in the Lord whose word I praise, in God I trust, I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me?" So, I exhort you, fear God, not man. When you begin to experience fear of man, and I've done it, I can remember specific times where I've been afraid. I've been fearful almost to the point of, I can't make a decision. I cannot move. I don't know what to do. I'm playing out all these scenarios in my mind. Well, this guy can do this to me. He can do this and this and this, and this would happen and this would happen, and then I'm going to be here. I was fearing him, fearing this person and what they could do to me, what I thought they could do to me. Instead, I wasn't fearing God. And I'm going to tell you, I was in that fear until God, and He let me be in fear for a while. And then what he reminded me, God reminded me, I got this under control. And guess what, Ben? If he does that, if he does do all that to you, and you do end up over here, it's because I let him do it. Because I wanted it done to you. Because I have a plan for you and a purpose for you. And that's part of it. And you don't like it? I know you don't like it. But that's okay. Because that's what I think is best for you. Number two, as you live in obedience to God, do so in courageous, outspoken faith. Again, why did David hide his actions from Achish? We went to great effort to show that his actions were in line with God's plan and purpose for Israel, for his people. So you can say he was in obedience in doing those acts when he went and destroyed those people. So why, when we're in obedience, now, I mean, this isn't just something that happened 4,000 years ago to David. This happens today. Why should you be fearful, or why should you be ashamed when you're actually going out and doing the things God wants you to do? I mean, David was bold when he went out to Goliath, wasn't he? Called him a dog. He said, I'm going to cut your head off and feed it to the birds. As one person put it, your head is going to become bird poop on my windshield. Right? The birds are going to eat it. Okay? I mean, really. That's what David said to him. Okay? When whether you're actually destroying an enemy of God or you're raising up warriors to destroy enemies of God, and you do it in faith. Do it with boldness. And if anybody asks you about it, say, yeah, what about it? David feared to some degree Achish, or he would not have been so vague. Why did he not go up to Achish and say the same thing? The Scriptures don't tell us. We can pull out from the Scriptures that I think David in his heart knew he didn't need to be in Philistia. He knew he was going to Achish for protection instead of to God for protection. He didn't want to mess up his protection, his protector. And he had total wrong person giving them the credit right then. Or the faith. He had faith in the wrong person at that point. So if you get asked about your actions when you're following in obedience to God, speak about them in confidence. Give praise to God. Be ready for the world to reject you, though. See, David didn't want Achish to reject him. It's going to make his life difficult. Be ready for that rejection, but don't let it keep it from doing what you know is right. In a sense, don't be ashamed of the gospel. Romans 1:16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jews first and also to the Greek, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. When you go out and you do in obedience, whatever it is you do, whether you handle a idiot driving the wrong way on the interstate, or you're talking with business people, helping them out, or you're changing a diaper, whatever you're doing, do it in obedience to God. And don't, if you are doing it in obedience to God, you don't have to apologize for that. And when you do it, you are speaking the gospel. And in fact, when you do it, and you do it in faith, so that you do it boldly, that doesn't mean in your face necessarily, but what I'm saying is that when you do it in a way that's God-honoring, usually somebody who God opens their eyes is going to go, Why do you do it that way? I've been watching you, and you do it this way. I don't understand why you do it that way. Be ready for that, because that's your opportunity to speak verbally what you've been speaking with your actions. And that's what Scripture says when it says, be ready to give an account for the faith that you have. That's a paraphrase. That's not exactly that. But those are your opportunities. That's what you should be living for, are those opportunities when somebody says, you're different. Now, sometimes it comes out, you're weird, or it comes out, you're stupid, or something like that. But that doesn't matter. You're different. If God is working in that person, He may very well, instead of them looking at you with disdain, like the world would normally do, because you're an offense to them, the Scripture says, they would actually say, you're different. Why? I might be interested in this. There you go. That's your opportunity. Don't blow it. Number three, rely on God, not man or yourself. Meditate on the ways that God has worked in your life. Don't forget them. Don't live in the past, but it's good to go back and meditate on the times that God has worked in your life. And you know what? Here's the thing. We should not give man credit. Too much credit. We give man too much credit sometimes. Because think about it. God does not usually part a Red Sea for us in physicalness and in like the miraculous. He doesn't talk to us that way, usually. He doesn't usually talk to us in English. He talks to us through His creation. He talks to us through other people. And He uses means to accomplish His purposes in our life. And He uses means to save us, to deliver us. And it can be easy to confuse, thinking, that person did that. That person saved me, you know, $100 because they're the ones who saw me drop it and give it back to me. Oh, I'm so thankful to you. Well, yes, you're thankful to them, but thank God, because God's the one who did it for you. Thank God for the dinners that are on your table because your wife prepared them for you. Or your children prepared them for you. Or whoever prepared them for you. Thank God for that. Because God's the one who delivered that for you. Thank God for the times when, you know, let's say if you're out and about and, you know, you get attacked and somebody comes up and rushes up and saves you. Thank God for that. Because God's the one who delivered you out of that. When somebody gives you good advice, thank God for the good advice, because God's the one who delivered you through that good advice. He used that person as a means to give you that advice. Thank God for the one who's providing for you, because your husband went out and was willing to work and make the money to provide for you. Don't get too caught up in the person, because it's God who's doing it through those people. So when you hit these situations, when you're like, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm afraid. Maybe the person who God's been using as a means is not around at this particular time. That doesn't mean God has left you. Just because His particular deliverer for you, He'll have another deliverer for you. Rely on God, not on man or yourself. Unbelief, this is Matthew Henry. Unbelief is a sin that easily besets even good men. When we're fighting without and within fears, and it's a hard matter to get over them. Lord, increase our faith. That's how we get over these fears.